If you haven't already, explore the many ways to connect with our show. Watch full uncut conversations on YouTube, gain AIA-approved continuing education credits through Arcademy, and make sure to check us out and follow us on social media at Detailed Podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
The city also wanted to see this overlook as, again, as I mentioned, this kind of Instagram moment of creating this kind of iconic civic landmark, as they called it. So for us, it was equally important that it function as resilience infrastructure with this kind of dune, the pavilion working together to buffer wind, storm surge, and sun exposure. And so the overlook really did embody the kind of ethos of the project, where we're merging infrastructure and sculpture into a single gesture that's protective, inspiring, and as we hope, unforgettable.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guest today is Jeffrey Huber, FAIA-ASLA, principal at Brooks & Scarpa with offices in California and Florida. As a matter of fact, Angie Brooks and Larry Scarpa were previous guests on Detailed. Jeffrey Huber, FAIA, ASLA, NCARB, Lead AP, WEDG, is a principal at Brooks & Scarpa, where he leads the firm's South Florida office. In addition to his practice, he is a professor at the School of Architecture at Florida Atlantic University. A distinguished architect and landscape architect, Huber specializes in public realm projects that seamlessly integrate ecological, landscape, urban, and architectural design. His research, teaching, and professional work have earned over 75 national design awards, including multiple honors from Progressive Architecture, the American Institute of Architects, the American Society of Landscape Architects, the American Architecture Awards, and the Association of Collegiate Schools of Architecture. The project we're talking about today is the D.C. Alexander Park in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. DC Alexander Park transforms a former beachfront parking lot into a layered coastal landscape, where infrastructure, ecology, and public life converge. Charged with reimagining this space by the city of Fort Lauderdale, the project culminates in climate resilience, historical importance, and public accessibility.
The client for DC Alexander Park is the city of Fort Lauderdale. And so they came to us with essentially an underused parking lot on the narrow barrier island. Right across the street is the beach. To the east, you know, it's the beach. And then to the west is actually the International Swimming Hall of Fame. And so the city had committed to a decade-long program of coastal resilience investments in this area. They are calling and branding the Loop. And so this was one of the sites that we had an opportunity to turn this asphalt into something much more. It was a public space that would absorb floodwaters, could provide shade, and reconnect people to both the beach and to the city. DC Alexander was actually one of the first pioneering developers on the beach, actually founding this area and bringing it urban development to the area. And so that's where the name of the park actually, or where it gets its name. So those were all kind of interesting tidbits, but it wasn't just about resilience in the technical sense that the city wanted us to look at. The site has many layers of that history from DC Alexander and beyond, from its days as a Las Olas casino pool to its role as a Seminole trading post. And then it also standing right in the middle of the current park, or when we first came to the park, is a Peter Wolf Tulth's Whispering Giant sculpture, which was placed there in 1983 as part of his Trail of Tears series. And so this is like a 30-foot tall cypress bust memorializing indigenous presence in this place. And so we felt it was important to honor and retain that sculpture, even if the park around it was now completely reimagined. And so the city's need for resilience and community space was one option. But for us, the design challenge was also broader. How do we create an environment that protects against sea level rise, storms, restores ecosystems, and in essence, rewilding the site, and at the same time acknowledges the cultural and historical significance of the site? So we became involved because the city of Fort Lauderdale was looking for a design partner that could merge, you know, all these different things, but specifically the resilience, ecology, and public space into one cohesive project. And our firm was already, or had already been working in that space. So both through BuiltWorks and through my own research like Salty Urbanism, which focuses on strategies for adapting to sea level rise and climate stressors. So, you know, when the city set out to reimagine DC Alexander Park, we were invited to bring that perspective, not just designing a park, but designing an urban landscape that acts as an infrastructure. Keith was the local landscape and civil engineering firm. And so they asked us to partner with them. And we brought along RGD as well as EES Design Studio. And later on, Shift Construction, who was the contractor, came on board. And so as an entire team, you know, we were really trying to postulate and kind of formulate the goals that were to create something that would protect the shoreline, restore habitat, provide passive play that feels joyful and civic. And so in that way, it was a somewhat natural fit for our practice because, again, we were looking at how do we blur the lines between architecture, landscape, and urban design, and this project needed all three working together.
The design reintroduces two historically significant systems, the coastal dune and tropical maritime hammock, onto the urban shoreline, while a sculptural ramping dune rises to a dramatic 25-foot cantilevered overlook, offering sweeping views of the Atlantic Ocean.
At its core, the project transformed this essentially about 1.2 acres of beachfront asphalt. Again, it was a former parking lot into a resilient public park. So that meant completely rethinking the site as a layered infrastructure. And so we wanted to restore coastal dunes, looking at hammock ecosystems, creating shaded plazas, passive recreation spaces, an integrated playscape that also doubles as protective landscape. And the centerpiece was this ramping dune that also rises into a sculptural pavilion and a cantilevered overlook. It's both an iconic public art piece as well as a piece of resilience infrastructure. And so around that, we rebuilt the site with the native plantings that could absorb stormwater, mitigate flooding, creating habitat, while also designing a civic plaza that calms traffic and then reconnects to future development that's happening and currently occurring across the street. So the scope wasn't just about landscape beautification. It was about creating, again, a hybrid ecology, infrastructure, and public space all within a relatively compact site.
Several agencies and departments collaborated to bring this ambitious park to life, with careful attention to environmental considerations such as compliance with the, yes, I'm about to say this, the Sea Turtle Lighting Ordinance. That was a new one to me.
this planning process was as much about coordination as it was about design. Because the site sits on a barrier island, we weren't just working with the city of Fort Lauderdale. We were working with the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. We were working with the Florida Department of Transportation. We had to navigate multiple layers of agencies beyond even these, coastal regulators, Parks and Recreation Department, Public Works Department, and even the very specific things like the sea turtle lighting ordinances. This was part of our urban beaches, and they're at the front line of protecting endangered sea turtles. And just to kind of touch on that turtle lighting here for a second, you know, my wife and my oldest daughter currently volunteer with a group called Stop Sea Turtle Oversight Protection. This organization monitors nests and rescues hatchlings, especially when they get disoriented from light pollution and overdevelopment. So just this past weekend, as I was volunteering with them and saw my first green turtle hatching, and it was a magical and honestly, like I said, life-altering kind of sight, but it reminded me of how fragile and interconnected these systems really are and how meaningful something that we had to take on at DC Alexander as one of these kind of agencies involved really is critical. And, you know, it's kind of allowed me to understand what we need to do as architects, as landscape architects, to really see and make sure our ecosystems and these kind of endangered species can thrive, and why these regulations are in place in the first place. So in the parks planning, we really did have to align with a lot of resilience goals. So we had to do storm surge modeling. Floodplain requirements were also critical, but accessibility, habitat restoration, and the city's clear directive that this wasn't just only about protection. It had to be civic. It had to be beautiful and welcoming and what they called an Instagram moment. That's what they wanted to see in the city. And so the process really became about weaving all of those voices, all of these requirements into one cohesive project that's what our role was, taking on, again, this resilience, this infrastructure and ecology, and translating them into a public space that could perform technically, but also would bring joy to the community and to the residents, as well as to the visitors of the city of Fort Lauderdale.
The lengthy permitting process involves city, state, and federal compliance through FEMA to consider all parameters of the project's complexity.
Well, I always say, you know, there's wicked problems and then there's wicked permitting, you know, and that's really what this project had to go through. It was quite an extensive process because you had to set up from the state level through even FEMA requirements, which were federal, but you're still going through state and local jurisdictions like the county as the floodplain manager there. You know, all of these things had to be put into place. And that was probably about a 9-month process before we could even submit to a permit at the city of Fort Lauderdale. And that was another lengthy process because, you know, they're more concerned about, you know, zoning, other controls, setback issues, but also about the Florida Building Code and those kind of ramifications that we had to think through. So life safety, fire, egress, all those kind of things that you are also challenged on top of these projects was really had to be sussed out, really organized, and really kind of tangibly cataloged and planned throughout that process. But I would say, yeah, I mean, it's pretty standard these days for a project, especially in the public realm, to some cases take 9 to 12 months of permitting to get through these because of that multi-jurisdictional, multi-agency kind of faceted aspect of them, the complexity of them too.
The 1.2-acre site along Fort Lauderdale Beach is reconceived not as a static open space, but as a resilient civic landscape shaped by architectural form and ecological process. Part of the site transformation required archaeological excavation to preserve artifacts and remove detritus.
The site was about a 1.2-acre parking lot. So it's not that it was that big. It's relatively flat, hot, and highly vulnerable to flooding and storm surge. And that's kind of what we took on ecologically. It was a dead zone. It was impermeable, had a lot of impervious surfaces. It's heat absorbing, so it created a lot of heat island. And it was cut off from the surrounding coastal systems and really the community in general. It was a kind of hostile site. It's located on the barrier island. It gave us an incredible proximity to the beach, but also to the breezes that we could really take advantage of. But as I mentioned before too, the cultural landmark that already existed on the site with Tooth's Whispering Giant sculpture. And, you know, that was all pretty important, but it was interesting as they started excavating, we did find the old casino foundations. And this was the saltwater pool that was on the site previously. But they also found an incredible amount of First People or Native American artifacts from the Tedesqua and other tribes that were here long before the Seminole or Miccosukee tribes that we see presently here today. And so it was interesting, as the contractor was in there, we had an archaeologist on site looking and making sure that we didn't come across human remains. But we did come across a lot of artifacts, a lot of tools, especially conch shell tools, which was pretty spectacular and amazing. So, you know, going back to like the fact that the asphalt was there and offered very little, there was a lot happening with the combination of the place, the history, and the cultural meaning that gave us this opportunity to completely rethink the site. And we were able to peel back some of that hardscape and rebuild it as a kind of living infrastructure for the next 50 to 100 years. And so this was something that could serve as both a model for climate adaptation, but also a place for cultural play and cultural respect. When we wrote the specifications, there was a requirement to have an archaeologist because we knew how cultural sensitive the site was and the history that the site had. And so that presence of ensuring that an archaeologist was there whenever we were doing any excavation, especially for the foundations of the new park, and we were coming in and finding some of these artifacts, the archaeologist did come and they would make sure that there was no bone material present, human remains especially. You know, there was a lot of oyster shells as well as these other kind of conch shell on there because, you know, that was primarily a lot of the diet of the Native Americans that were here first in there. And so we found a lot of that, but how they used those and employed those as tools. So it slowed the project down, but it didn't stop the project because really we just had to go ahead and make sure the archaeologists were there and would go ahead and essentially take that material, catalog that material, and ensure that there was nothing else. So it was kind of haphazard. And keep in mind, that site was already heavily impacted from these casino, the pool that was built in the 1920s, all the way to the kind of developments that came through all the way to our time. So to find artifacts that were still there from predating that time was quite spectacular. And ironically, could have even been brought in from another site just with fill and sand that was being brought in there. And so when you're saying the geotechnical reports, when we got them in here, I mean, the site is primarily sand, but it also has what's called muck. And muck was essentially a nice glorified word for dead mangroves. It was like the things that they basically would put soil on top of and allowed. And so when we got into some of the mangrove areas, that's where we'd see less of the Native American habitat or Native American settlements, because it was obvious that was more the areas that flooded. And it's just ironic on a 1.2 acre area, but because we're on the barrier island, you had some extreme elevation changes. Like in some cases, just on this one site, we had about 12 foot of elevation change historically. If you went there today, because we denuded a lot of the landscape and brought in a lot of fill, it looks like a flat site. But historically speaking, it would have probably had about 12 feet of change, which is drastic when you talk about Florida, especially a county like Broward County, where, you know, our highest elevation above sea level was 22 feet. And it's probably for less than 1% of the total land mass, where on average, we're about 4 feet above sea level. So you can see that kind of extreme elevation changes kind of creates, you know, some unique challenges in this particular area to essentially a dynamic ecosystem, because it is a barrier island.
Fully grasping the historical, cultural, and ecological significance of the site at large presented a definitive design challenge for the project.
The most challenging thing for the site, you know, was, again, kind of understanding the history, understand the cultural significance, but really, you know, understanding what was historically there, especially as an ecosystem. And so I always like to, as an architect and as a landscape architect, start off thinking about the geology, the hydrology, and the ecology of the site. And so we layered in thinking about the barrier island ecosystems and beginning to delaminate it and understand the dunes versus the coastal strand versus the maritime harbored hammocks, and even going back to mangrove forests and really understanding this dynamics of this ecosystem and how we would begin to design and plan and manage and think about those aspects when delivering this project.
The design strategy botanizes the site by reinstating critical coastal ecosystems into the urban shoreline. These systems not only restore ecological vitality, but also reduce storm surge impacts, positioning the park as both a neighborhood amenity and a protective buffer.
So when we say the park botanizes the asphalt, we mean it replacing a dead, impermeable surface with living infrastructure, with living landscape that performs multiple functions. Landscape can no longer be seen as decoration. It must be seen as infrastructural. And that's a cognitive leap for a lot of people when you're thinking about a plant in the same way as a pipe. But for us, it's almost essential and quintessential to think about it in that way. So the asphalt was essentially a heat island that was shedding water straight into the stormwater system and back to the ocean. If we're talking about water quality issues, we're also talking about extreme heat and other things. So by peeling back and peeling away and rebuilding the site with these dunes, these hammocks, the native coastal vegetation, we turn the ground itself back into infrastructure. And so plants like sea grapes, gumbo limbo, the buttonwoods don't just look good, but they also help to stabilize the soil, absorb stormwater, provide shade, and create habitat. And so botanizing is really about giving the site back to nature in a way that still supports people. And it's taking something lifeless and making it into a resilient ecological system that doubles as a civic park.
Ecological strata are expressed architecturally. Root dunes become sculpted landforms that buffer storm surge, while hammock plantings form shaded outdoor rooms at the park's perimeter. Together, they frame a sequence of spaces that transition from active play to contemplative respite.
I mean, root dunes is very similar to sand dunes, but you know, I don't like to call things sand dunes because it's not really the appropriate term. Sand dunes are what you'd find out in a desert, but root dunes is really what we have on the coast here, and it's sand dunes that have plants in them. So those roots are essentially an engineered landform that, in the case of our project, we use the root dunes to essentially engineer a landform that was designed to mimic natural coastal dunes. And we shape the mounds with sand and soil. We then stabilize them with native vegetation whose roots bind the earth together. And so when you think about what you see on top of the root or on top of the mounds or on top of these dunes, grasses can be as high as 2-3 feet tall. Well, if you think about the flip side of that, that's what their root system is. It's about this doubling. So what you usually see on top is happening below the ground. And that can really stabilize. So these roots do a lot of real work. They lock the dunes in place first and foremost against erosion, absorbing stormwater, and then allowing the land to flex and recover after events like king tides we're just in right now, as well as any storm surges that happen from the coastline. And so over time, wind and sand also migrates and actually helps the dunes to grow stronger and builds them up. So it's a kind of self-reinforcing system. Since the installation in October of last year, I mean, we've actually seen these dunes, these root dunes have grown several inches higher. So they're actually working as intended. And on the site, the dunes, you know, aren't just protection and vegetation. There's also these other rubberized dunes that we call them. And these are part of the playscape that kids can climb on, that they can slide on. So the landscape, again, functions both as infrastructure, but also as recreation. And so that's the beauty of it, resilience and joy in the same kind of gesture that these root dunes kind of provide. We learned a lot of lessons even after like Hurricane Irma and a lot of these hurricanes that have come and actually shoved a lot of the sand from the beach over back onto A1A. And so this was one of the issues that we were really trying to solve for in the project, was restoring this kind of dunescape that could help stabilize the soil and the sand in place. A hammock ecosystem, at least for us here in South Florida, it's a maritime tropical hardwood hammock or a forest, if you will. And so these developed on slightly elevated ground in the kind of coastal South Florida context where I mostly practice. And so the word hammock here doesn't mean something that you swing in. It's referring to an ecological island of trees and vegetation surrounded by wetlands and lower ground. And so these ecosystems were incredibly important because they act like natural sponges. They help to absorb and filter rainwater, buffer against flooding, and provide critical habitat for native plants and wildlife. And so they also offer shade and cooling, which is essential in this kind of hot urban environment like Fort Lauderdale. So again, by reintroducing this kind of idea of the hammock in the edge around the park, we not only restored the parts of the area's ecological heritage, but also created shading, gathering places, and resilient infrastructure that helps the city adapt to rising seas, but also heavier storms. And we're seeing a lot more frequent of those in the last few years.
At its core, the park operates as a boundless playscape where rubberized surfaces and vegetated dunes integrate recreation with performance infrastructure. The topographic manipulation culminates in a ramping dune that rises to a 25-foot cantilevered overlook.
I would say one of the most striking features is the ramping dune that rises into this kind of sculptural pavilion and cantilevered overlook. And it's not just about an elevated platform. It is a biomorphic kind of form that blends landscape and architecture. It's also shielding the playground playscape around it while still remaining open to the street. And so the overlook is also universally accessible, and it serves as a public art and fulfills the city's goal of creating this kind of iconic gathering spot. Another unique aspect is how the landscape itself performs as infrastructure, as I've already been talking about. The root dunes and the hammock ecosystem act as a kind of natural flood control. They absorb stormwater, they buffer storm surge. Over time, they'll also continue to grow stronger as wind and sand migrate naturally across the site. And so I always say, you know, landscape in this point, you know, if we look at a pipe like you would look at beer has a shelf life. It has an age. It will get worse as it gets older, where this landscape, especially when you think about landscape as infrastructure, it's like wine. It gets better with age. It gets more resilient over time. And so, you know, we really are considering how we also design the coastal plaza on the park's edge that calms traffic, provides shaded gathering spaces. It's planted with native vegetation, native species like I mentioned before, sea grapes, gumbo limbo, and buttonwood. And even the play equipment and rubberized surfacing were integrated into that kind of resilient strategy that doubles as infrastructure while creating a kind of joyful space for children and families to play and gather. And so what makes this project unique is that every element, whether it's these kind of dune, a tree, a plaza, or a piece of sculpture, serves multiple roles: ecological, civic, and even experiential and experimental, that it couldn't be value engineered out too. I think that's a critical aspect of this project. We were looking at, and all too often many projects get under what we all refer to as value engineering, but sometimes I call it just what it really is, devalue engineering. And so, you know, it's that point of looking at how do we design critical and functional, as well as long-term maintenance and operational, as well as economic value into the overall design. And so that every dollar that was spent in construction was going to save $7 in the long run due to integrative and resilient design techniques and strategies on the project.
Both sculptural and functional, the overlook reads as a piece of public art while simultaneously extending the protective coastal ridge. Its universal accessibility reinforces the project's commitment to inclusion, allowing all visitors to engage with the elevated horizon line of the Atlantic.
First and foremost, we have to actually design to 180 mile per hour sustained wind loads here, and much over 200 miles per hour for 3 second gusts. And so it really makes it difficult to build in Miami-Dade and Broward County. Broward County is where we're located here at Fort Lauderdale. Miami-Dade is obviously where Miami is, but these two counties, more so than any other area in the United States, have to deal with these phenomenal wind loads. And so the overlook and the cantilevered overlook specifically, I mean, this was really the heart of the park. It's a 25-foot cantilevered platform that rises over this kind of ramping dune and projects dramatically towards the ocean. I often say it's going to be the best spot in Fort Lauderdale to watch the sunrise and the moonrise. You know, we don't, unfortunately, since we're facing east, don't get to watch the sunset. And that's something you definitely get from the Pacific Ocean. But here, there's something else more unique and special, I think, when you're on the Atlantic, especially on this east coast side of Florida. And so structurally, it's a very muscular concrete structure and steel frame, even in that structure, but also above. And we wrapped that steel frame structure above in this kind of perforated metal skin. And that this essentially kind of glows both dawn and dusk. We wanted to give it a kind of lighting, a kind of ethereal quality to this. But, you know, to mention and talk about the concrete work, I mean, this, we learned a lot of lessons from Surfside and the Champlain South Tower collapse in Surfside a few years back, where, you know, 99 people lost their lives, unfortunately. And that was due to overexposure and corrosion in the context of a building that was just over 40 years old, but it was this constant saltwater spray on it, but also the saltwater kind of encroachment into the water table, all of these kind of excessive challenges. And so when we designed this concrete structure for DC Alexander Park, we wanted to ensure we did some lessons learned there. And so we actually integrated galvanized steel reinforcement. It's far stronger concrete than it had to be, but we also integrated a product, a waterproofing agent, into the concrete that essentially makes it impregnable to water, whether it be salt water or fresh water. And so this really created a combination to heavily protect this structure from that constant bombardment that was going to get in the context. And so, you know, we wanted to also see that this thing functionally, it worked at multiple levels. It's universally accessible, this overlook. So anyone, whether they're on foot or in a wheelchair or with a stroller, can spiral up the dune and really enjoy these panoramic views of the beach and the horizon. It also provides shade and shelter to the playground beneath. And so it doubles as this kind of elevated gathering space and a protective canopy or community porch at the bottom. We also partnered with Eric Small. He's an engineer and an artist, and his team at EES Design Studio here in Fort Lauderdale, they were critical partners in making the overlook possible. So Eric is both, like I said, an engineer and an artist, and his fabrication expertise ensured that the perforated skin, the structural system, weren't just beautiful, but also durable enough to withstand the constant salt air, hurricanes, and extreme coastal conditions. Their craftsmanship really gave the overlook the longevity it needs to thrive in this environment. And so I remember when we first brought him our design proposal, and he was just like, "You want me to build this right where it's going to be? And 180 miles, like, Jeff, are you kind of crazy? Is Brooke Scarpa, like, you know, we need to check on you, you know?" But it was an amazing partnership, because he was able to kind of look and talk, and he does and builds a lot of Alice Aycock sculptures in New York and around the globe, quite frankly. And so he had this expertise of projects that public art that he's built in Abu Dhabi, other public art that he's done along coastlines, and was able to bring that to bear for us. And so the city also wanted to see this overlook as I mentioned, this kind of Instagram moment of creating this kind of iconic civic landmark, as they called it. So for us, it was equally important that it function as resilience infrastructure with this kind of dune, the pavilion working together to buffer wind, storm surge, and sun exposure. And so the overlook really did embody the kind of ethos of the project, where we're merging infrastructure and sculpture into a single gesture that's protective, inspiring, and as we hope, unforgettable.
Given the site's proximity to the beach and exposure to annual storms, the elevated water table demanded a robust foundation system and significant infrastructure engineering.
Well, there's a lot of piles that basically create friction piles that are 40 foot deep that are holding this whole thing up and create a kind of bearing pressure. But being right there on the barrier island, the site doesn't really have a conventional water table, but it does sit over what we call a freshwater lens. And so essentially this is where the salt water goes completely underneath the island and pushes up this freshwater through a capillary action. So all the rainwater essentially is what's collected there and creates this freshwater lens. And so you hit this saturated soil at just a few feet down. And in some cases, depending on where you are, it could be an inch down. That meant every time we excavated, the pits filled with water almost immediately. And so we had to really challenge ourselves and try to work during the dry season, where the water table was much lower, try to avoid any kind of the dewatering. So for something like the cantilever overlook, we really needed to have a massive foundation. And that was a huge challenge. Like I mentioned, there's 40-foot friction piles at about 3 foot on center all through this, holding this up. And so there's a lot of infrastructure you just don't see above the ground that's below it. And so in fact, when viewers, and they may get a kick out of this, the concrete that supports the chin of the column was called out to be 12,000 PSI concrete. So it's quite strong. I mean, conventionally speaking, most concrete's about 2,500 pounds per square inch is given the typical. And this was 12,000 PSI. So it was about 10 times what we would typically see, or, you know, five times what you would typically see as the strength of concrete, just for components that were holding this cantilever portion. To address the existing water, you know, we used some dewatering systems through the construction and specified structural systems, as I've already mentioned, that could really live in this environment for decades. You know, thinking about the fact that we were integrating Penetron or Zypex type of additives into the concrete that makes it kind of impregnable to water, for example, and also the use of galvanized rebar in the concrete mix that were all corrosion inhibitors and that would resist, again, the saltwater intrusion on there. But the freshwater lens also points to a bigger story about sea levels and their current rising. So the pressure on the lens will increase, pushing this water even closer to the surface and compounding flooding waters and corrosion risks in the long run. And so we had to design with that future in mind. So instead of treating the water table like a one-time obstacle, we really saw it as something that was ongoing condition of the site, was constantly a dynamic system that was in flux, and as well it would be a even more of a omnipresent kind of issue in the future. And so we built the resilience into the park that could adapt and endure to that current and future condition.
The coastal site itself presented a challenge in critical construction to handle extremely high wind loads and manage long-term saltwater corrosion.
Oh, this project has a lot of stories. I guess one of the biggest challenges for it was, you know, like we were just talking about, the high water table and the coastal site that we've been talking about this whole time. The minute we began excavation, we hit saturated soils a few feet down. These were huge issues that when we were trying to pour the foundation strong enough for to supporting this 25-foot cantilever, we had to kind of work through. So the solution was the mix of engineering and sequencing. We looked at how we were excavating, but the structural team specifying concrete with admixture, the galvanized rebar to protect against this kind of long-term saltwater corrosion. We were literally building resilience into the structure from the ground up. And that challenge came to, you know, also with another component of the overlook, the perforated metal skin. The geometry was complex, and in the coastal environment, the finishes had to be flawless. We had to work hand in hand with Eric Small, like I mentioned, his team at EES Design Studio, who treated these custom pieces of sculpture, you know, that were essentially adjusted and aligned until the skin read as one continuous glowing surface, but also they had to be corrosive and erosion and kind of thinking about all these other issues. And so I can't overstate, you know, too, how critical Schiff Construction was throughout the process. So Justin Schiff and his team, you know, who approached the job as true partners, not adversaries, but the projects like these are basically a 10,000 question test, and you're going to run into surprises or conditions that weren't in the drawings. And so what mattered was how we responded. And whenever an issue came up, Justin's team worked shoulder to shoulder with us to find alternatives and, you know, preserve the design intent. And that level of collaboration was essential. And it's a big reason the project not only overcame its challenges, but ended up even stronger and I think more beautiful while staying on schedule and within the original budget.
For Jeffrey, the transformation of a lifeless parking lot into a space that unites climate protection, cultural recognition, and functional art proved deeply rewarding.
To stand on the site now, walking among the sea grape and the kind of gumbo limbo trees, watching kids play on the dunes, or looking out over the overlook, you'd never guess it used to be a hot, lifeless parking lot. I mean, for me, what was truly telling and the favorite thing about the project was the day it opened and a child running past me and just him and his mom are walking by and we had just had the opening and his mom's like, he asked, who are you? And his mom's like, he was the architect. And the fact that the kids goes, you did this, you designed this, this is cool. You know, and it was like, that was a kind of amazing moment that really gives you this kind of clarity that it's, you know, even though all the stress, all the problems and all the things that you had to do, you would, at that moment, that's when it all just kind of sheds away and you realize that, you know, this complete reinvention of a kind of dead place or a dead piece of land into a kind of living, resilient, and joyful public space is incredibly rewarding. And so I also love the fact that the park works on many levels at once. And we've talked about some of those things. It's infrastructure, it's habitat, it's civic space, it's art. And but my favorite moment is really when I see people, like I said, using it. Families in the shade, kids climbing all over it, skating down the sloped walkway to the canopy, or someone even pausing at the overlook and taking a look at the ocean. That's when the project comes alive, and you see how resilience and design translated directly into a kind of quality of life project is extremely rewarding.
As both protective infrastructure and experiential landscape, DC Alexander Park advances a new model for coastal urbanism. Its design demonstrates how architectural form, ecological systems, and civic spaces can be synthesized into a resilient public realm that is simultaneously adaptive, inclusive, and artful. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious what Jeffrey thought were some of the biggest challenges currently being faced in landscape architecture.
The biggest challenge is scale, and it's going to be climate change and other related issues. So landscape architects are being asked to really solve some of the most pressing issues of our time. You know, again, like I said, climate change, sea level rise, heat, ecological collapse, but often on sites that are tiny in comparison to the scale of the problem. So we're constantly trying to connect to the small to the large, and how 1 acre of rewilded land, like the park we were just talking about, can have a ripple effect across an entire city's resilience. Another challenge is that our professions are often undervalued, are brought in too late. So yet, as DC Alexander Park showed, the landscape becomes infrastructure. It's the first line of defense against storms, heat, flooding. And the earlier landscape architect can get into a project, the earlier landscape architecture, for that matter, architecture too, is integrated into the planning, the better the outcome is for our communities. And so what keeps me up at night is urgency. We're running out of time to adapt our cities. The science is clear. Seas are rising. Storms are intensifying. And communities, especially vulnerable ones, are at risk. And so the question is whether we, as designers and policymakers, can move enough quickly and quickly enough to match the scale and the speed of those challenges.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Jeffrey. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
I guess I hope my impact is providing that design can be both practical and transformative. On one hand, our work must solve urgent, tangible problems like we were talking about here, sea level rise, flooding, affordable housing for that matter. But at the same time, design has the power to lift people up, to create joy, and to connect communities more deeply to one another and to the environment. And so great design should always build a place, history, and culture while preparing us for the future. And so I guess for me, the architecture and landscape architecture, as well as urban design, aren't separate disciplines. They're parts of the same system. And that's the perspective I bring to my practice. It's how I teach at places like Florida Atlantic University, where I teach architecture, and really try to push that resilience, equity, and beauty are not competing goals, that they are, inseparable, and that if future generations of designers and communities embrace that idea, I think I'd feel I've made a meaningful contribution. And that means it's beyond my own work and has a ripple effect beyond or within, others, within policymaking, which for me in our practice at Brooks Scarpa, we find much more profound in making lasting change is affecting others and affecting policy. And, at the human scale, my hope is that spaces we create resonate in people's lives, that children remember climbing and laughing in a park we've designed, as we were just talking about, or that a family finds shade or comfort that was not once there or was once an asphalt parking lot, that someone feels, pride in their community because of a place we helped shape. In the end, I want our work to demonstrate that design isn't just about buildings or landscapes. It's about creating systems of resilience and memories that leave communities stronger, more connected, and more hopeful.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.